On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. In his new book, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Suskind calls the guiding principle of the Bush administration's fight against global terror the 1% doctrine. It says that if there's even a 1% chance that al-Qaeda can get weapons of mass destruction, the U.S. must respond to the threat as if it's a certainty. According to Suskind, the doctrine was coined by Vice President Dick Cheney, who's portrayed as the puppeteer-in-chief to President Bush's puppet. It's a doctrine of unsettling implications, where belief and ideology trump analysis, where suspicion is the threshold for action. Suskind argues the doctrine guided the policies that led to war in Iraq, to the pursuit of alleged terrorists across the globe, and to a troubling concentration of power in the White House. Up next on Point, the hunt for America's enemies and the 1% doctrine. And joining me now from Washington, D.C. is author and journalist Ron Suskind. He's won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing at the Wall Street Journal, where he was senior national affairs reporter until 2000. And Ron Suskind, what a pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome.
It's pure joy, Anthony. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. And there's a lot we could be talking about beyond this book, but I think we got to focus on this book, which I got to say is a riveting, ripping read. Congratulations.
Well, thanks. I mean, it's a spy thriller with the future of the planet at stake.
Based on what's really happening.
Exactly. As true and harrowing as it could be.
Well, let's start off with this basic understanding of what you call the 1% doctrine. I laid it out in the billboard of the show, but it might be helpful for you to sort of spell it out and paint the scene, which you do in the book so vividly, about when this was born, this so-called 1% doctrine.
You want me to read a little passage
That
here,
would be or? Great. Yeah,
okay.
There's, I think on
there
page
is
a, 62.
On 62, yeah, there's a little something I could read here.
Yeah, start off
let me
that
set
way.
The scene. Yeah, let me set the scene a bit. It's November of 2001. The vice president in the Situation Room with folks from CIA and NSC is being delivered a harrowing bit of intelligence. Pakistani nuclear scientists had sat with bin Laden and Zawahiri just a few weeks before 9/11 in Kandahar around a campfire. And the discussion was about the feasibility of al-Qaeda getting a nuclear weapon. This is delivered to the vice president. It took a while to get the intelligence just so. And he's sitting there, and he's listening intently, hard-eyed, clamped down tight.
Before you do the reading, though, where's the president? The president's not at this meeting. It's Vice President
Cheney.
No, he's not.
Okay. The president's not at this meeting. Look, in large measure, the vice president is guiding affairs and policies in terms of foreign policy of the United States and certainly the war on terror. That's what you find from the book. The president certainly does get engaged, and you see that as well. But in terms of the global thinker of the two, it is the vice president. I think the best way to put it is that Dick Cheney has created a kind of platform, an architecture, in which George Bush can be George Bush and still be president, a man of action, indulging his gut, his instinct. But it's within a framework that is, for the most part, constructed by the master, Dick Cheney.
Okay, well, go ahead with this reading.
Yeah. Cheney says at one point during the briefing, we need to think about these low-probability, high-impact events in a different way. And by the end of the briefing, as it's finishing, he has that different way. And here's what he says. He says, if there's a 1% chance that Pakistani scientists are helping al-Qaeda build or develop a nuclear weapon, we need to treat it as a certainty in terms of our response, Cheney said. He paused to assess his declaration. It's not about our analysis or finding a preponderance of evidence, he added. It's about our response. So now spoken, it stood, a standard of action that would frame events and responses from the administration for years to come. The Cheney Doctrine. Even if there's just a 1% chance of the unimaginable coming due, act as if it's a certainty. It's not about our analysis, as Cheney said. It's about our response. The doctrine, the 1% solution, divided what had largely been indivisible in the conduct of American foreign policy, analysis and action. Justified or not, fact-based or not, our response is what matters. As to evidence, the bar was set so low that the word itself almost didn't apply. If there was even a 1% chance of terrorists getting a weapon of mass destruction, and there had been a small probability of such an occurrence for some time, the United States must now act as if it were a certainty. This was a mandate of extraordinary breadth. Everyone sat for a moment, rolling it over in their minds, sketching the implications.
Well, the implications are dramatic and troubling, and they have a lot to say about the way the U.S. led up to the war in Iraq, which you write about. But talk generally about this idea, about what bothers you or concerns you about this lowering the threshold for action in this so-called 1% doctrine.
Well, you know what, Cook? The fact is we know the place of evidence in governments born of Enlightenment principles, age of reason, ideals. Evidence matters. Evidence is what underlies our legal system. It underlies actions of government, and for a reason. Evidence matters in terms of getting to judgment, getting to issues of culpability, knowing who is appropriate to receive the sanction or worse of an entity certainly as powerful as the U.S. government. At this point, Cheney, essentially, after all of his years of fighting battles inside of the government, policy battles, where sometimes the facts don't comport with what he may want or what a politician may want, Cheney essentially severs the tie. He liberates the government from the dictates of evidence, that slow-footed world of search and find, of the known and knowable, of policy debates that roil this way and that. He's saying that is all past tense. At this point, we will act for good reason, bad reason, or no discernible reason. It could be mere suspicion now that guides the United States, the world's most powerful nation, in what it does from this point forward. And of course, it's audacious, not only in terms of the burdens it places on the United States, but also in terms of how it essentially looses us. It unattaches us from our moorings as a nation.
Mm. As you suggest, it's Dick Cheney who's behind this policy and essentially in charge and guiding American administration policy when it comes to these matters. How do you know that? And I guess this is a question about sources. Who are the people in the administration? And I'm not asking you to reveal your sources, but characterize them. Who are the people in the administration who are telling you that they're concerned about this, about Cheney's approach or his motives?
There are more than 100 key sources that cooperated with this project. Many of them, of course, are out of the government now, but frankly, many of them are still inside of the government, active day to day in the conduct of the war on terror and the strategies or lack thereof that abides that war. You know, look, the fact is that the White House doesn't dispute anything in the book because, of course, they've lived it. They know all of this is true. And, you know, and part of them, you know, many folks who are admirers of the president and the vice president are saying, look, there's a lot in this book we don't like. Actually, it was Sean Hannity the other night. I was on Hannity on Hannity and Combs. Mm. It's like, look, a lot about this book we hate, but a lot, you know, it's true. And God bless it. It shows the president and the vice president doing what they do. And so let's talk about the parts we like. When you hit a ball straight down the middle on a controversial story, both sides are going to have problems. They'll find things they like. They'll find things they hate. And that's the way this book is written. It is not polemical. It is not political. It's about the real story of the war on terror, what we've learned, what we haven't, and what's up ahead in terms of the key issue. How do we win it without compromising what makes us unique as a democracy? If we do that, we will have really lost.
Mm. Well, Ron, how might this 1% doctrine apply, for example, with something that's ongoing today, the standoff with Iran over its nuclear program? I mean, give us a sense of the implications here and the fallout.
Yeah, absolutely. Iran or North Korea, for that matter.
Yeah.
Essentially, what the 1% doctrine says is that action matters. Any action is an inherent good, whatever the justification. The president often calls that a game changer. It establishes a status quo. It makes your enemies, and even in some cases your friends, respond. You act, they react. So nobody has time to stop and think and plan what they want to do. Continuous action has clearly been a model for the Bush administration. Act and then act again and act a third time. And no one has much time to stop and think, in many cases challenge, or ask for the good enough reasons. People say, I just want to know the reasons behind the action. And frankly, by then, they're already on to the next thing. That could have implications for Iran. The fact is that we have all manner of fears and suspicions and frustrations as to Iran and what they've done. We may want to make them a demonstration model for U.S. power in a way like we did with Iraq, though that demonstration model seems to have failed.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, when it comes to Iraq, applying this doctrine to Iraq, there was a lot of talk before the war about why we had to go to war. You write that, according to your sources, the war in Iraq was primarily waged to make an example of Saddam Hussein. That is, that was the goal from the get-go.
Exactly. And to be blunt about it, Anthony, they should have come to the American people and said, this is why we want to go to war in Iraq. The whole issue about whether Saddam had or didn't have weapons of mass destruction, that evidentiary kind of sell, that pitch, inside the White House, it was always seen as a faithless exercise, just marketing and advertising for the most part, because people had already divorced themselves inside of the White House based on the Cheney Doctrine and their views as to the primacy of American power for whatever reason we want to exercise it. They divorced themselves from the dictates of evidence long before we were out making our case, so to speak, before the world community.
It's clear that this is a very unsettling portrait you paint of the guiding principle behind U.S. foreign policy. At the same time, let's be clear here, 9/11, we all know what happened. We all saw what happened. This is an administration that, faced with a threat that was unprecedented, doesn't sort of robust action, isn't robust action called for in this case? And I guess I'm looking for, don't we understand where the administration is coming from with this new sort of lower threshold for action given the times we live in?
Well, there's no doubt that folks who are supporters of the administration are right now holding the book up and saying, love us or leave us, the 1% doctrine is what choice do we have? That is the guiding principle. This is the core of the playbook. Now it's out. Let's talk about it. In support of just the points you're alluding to, we are faced with a terrible new kind of conflict. And it's really born of this huge historical change. The fact is the miracle of the information age, we all know about that, how it's empowered people around the globe. The dark cousin that's come to the party is destructive capability that is now carried on civil technology, spored information. It's easily downloadable. So now individuals or small groups can carry the destructive power once reserved for nations. That's a huge change in history. Mm. We're trying to deal with that now as the world's great superpower. But it's been difficult. And I think the key here is that everyone is running up a learning curve, not just inside of the government, but beyond it here in America, elsewhere in the world, as to, let's just say, the perils of action that is not bound or directed by evidence, by the traditional lights of sober due diligence that has always attended what the United States certainly has done. Hmm. We're seeing all sides of it now and feeling it in many cases.
I wanted to go back to this idea of so much of this policy coming from Dick Cheney, who's really now in charge of this policy, according to your book. You write that inside the CIA, he had a nickname, Edgar, as in Edgar Bergen, casting Mr. Bush as the puppet, Charlie McCarthy. And I wanted to get you to comment about that, but where I'm going with this is this deliberate policy, you say, that exists to keep certain information from President Bush. And why?
Well, the vice president, Dick Cheney, has innovated these ideas, has developed them all the way back to the Ford administration he started. And I have lots of people talking about moments where they'd mention something to President Ford and Cheney would cut them off. The president doesn't need to know that. If he knew that or knows that, he will then be accountable for that information. Cheney has taken that down a path of R&D since then. And in this administration, there are many things that I find in the book I show where the briefing book stops at Cheney's desk. What the president knows is essentially what Cheney decides he ought to know. What that does in the modern age, where, as Don Rumsfeld says, information is part of the toolkit of warfare, one of the devices we'll use here, frankly, and abroad. You know, there's a lot of disinformation that essentially the administration feels is part of what they need to do in the war on terror. What this does is it allows the president to be deniable about his own statements, statements that circle the globe, often roil the globe. They may not be true, but the president is kept essentially from culpability or accountability as to knowing better.
And in your reporting, was there some sense you got that the president is complicit in this? I mean, does he approve of this? I mean, is he saying, look, don't tell me what I don't need to know?
Look, I am of the mind that the president is accountable for the White House he develops. White Houses essentially channel the personality and ideas of the president. That's why presidents, as they say, get the White Houses they deserve. I have no doubt that the president understands what's going on. He's a shrewd guy. He might not be terrific at press conferences or in interviews, but he's got a tactical acuity that his opponents all know about. And you'll see that in the book. He's quite operational in the war on terror. He's there. He likes the operators. A lot of presidents, you know, they all get briefed, of course. They incline toward the analysts. An event occurs. The analysts come in, describe the issues for a nation or a region. The president, though, he likes the operators.
People who come in and say, here's what we're going to do. We're going to kick some butt, and this is the way we're going to do it, and here's the plan.
Guys with blood and dirt in their fingers. Mm. He wants the stories. He loves the stories. You know, and he gets right into the weeds, right into the granularity of it. And sometimes this causes trouble in the government, and I show that. They call it going operational, as someone at CIA says. You know, think of it. It's like a case officer in training, the president, with absolute powers. So Bush will fire questions across the room, and half the government will kick into overdrive, maybe following down a lead that they already know from the start is fruitless.
I want to ask you, there's a really compelling example about that, but I also want to be sensitive to our listeners. We have a lot of callers backed up. Let's take a call from Samantha, who's calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hi, Samantha.
Hello. I just wanted to make the comment that although I personally find the 1% doctrine a little startling in the context of the war on terror, it might actually have benefited us in, let's say, maybe there's a 1% chance or better that we won't be greeted as liberators in Iraq, or a 1% chance or better that global warming actually is a reality, or a 1% chance or better that Katrina will get blown away by a hurricane. These kinds of things, I just think it could have been more widely applied and useful in that way.
Interesting. Samantha, thanks for the call. What do you think of that, Ron? I mean, is this 1% doctrine, this applies only to the war on terror, the pursuit of America's enemies, correct?
Boy, Samantha, you are a smart cookie there. That's a very, very interesting analysis that the 1% doctrine is exclusively for the conduct of U.S. foreign policy in the war on terror. And had they been similarly vigilant, you know, if you want to use the word vigilant, or full of hair trigger sensibilities about other threats facing the country, like global warming or Katrina, we'd probably be in a different boat than we're in now.
You know, Ron, before Samantha's call, you were talking about the result of this 1% doctrine, and it results in a lot of people sort of flying off in different directions and pursuing things in this sort of quest for action, any action. And in your book, you drop several sort of bombshells about the administration's war on terror, and I'd like you to talk about one case in point, and that is the celebrated capture of Abu Zubaydah in Pakistan in 2002, who the administration described as al-Qaeda's chief of operations. And, you know, it was a major coup and a major arrest. You find something else out in this book.
Right, in a way they garnered lots of political capital at the time. You know, part of the book, what it shows is that disinformation is the policy of the U.S. government toward its own people. Information warfare, it's here and abroad. And here you've got Zubaydah. Let's set the scene. It's the spring of 2002. We had failed in Afghanistan after all of our efforts to catch bin Laden or Zawahiri, even Mullah Omar. The Taliban leader slipped away. There was great yearning to get a big catch, a big capture, and the White House was anxious to write that press release. We catch Zubaydah. Zubaydah had popped up for years on so-called signal intelligence, you know, the NSA stuff, the wiretap stuff, using his real name. We couldn't figure that out. And we do get him in Pakistan. It's interesting. We immediately, of course, trumpet him as the first of the number threes. There have been many since then. Hmm. You know, he's the key operator. He's a man of malevolence. He's planning operations. Even while the president is saying this, inside of the innermost councils, the locked rooms at FBI and CIA, they're reading Zubeda's diary, and they're finding out a few things. Zubeda was not involved in some of the key things we thought he was involved in. A and B, the diary is written across 10 years in the voice of three different characters of different ages, Hani 1, Hani 2, Hani 3. Lots of quotidian, meaningless, trifling little details, who's drinking what tea, who's wearing what. Zubeda, essentially, though he did recruitment, he was essentially kind of a travel agent. He was, you know, in a company, he's the guy in the corporate travel office. He's not the COO or CEO or CFO.
But this idea that he was writing in different voices suggests that he was not mentally complete. I mean, that
he was not mentally complete.
Right,
he was a split personality. That may be one of the reasons why Al-Qaeda let him go around the world using his real name on phones and things like that. He was expendable. Now, he did give us some information that was valuable. The book points that out. He told us exactly who Mukhtar, who appeared on Signal Intelligence, that means the brain in Arabic, who that was. That was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the 9/11 planner. That was valuable. He told us about Jose Padilla. But then what he does is he just starts to talk. He was tortured. The book shows exactly what went on.
We should just point out he was subjected to rendition, correct?
He was
exported to another country where he was subjected to torture.
Precisely. And it was quite virulent, the torture. He was actually, interestingly, nursed back to health. We sent some of the best doctors we could find in America, as someone in the CIA said, to get him back to good health so we could begin to torture him. Mm. And, of course, we did. And in that torture, he starts to just talk and talk and talk. And we are following leads and various utterances of Zubeda to the Brooklyn Bridge and the Statue of Liberty, everything under the sun. Uniformed people in America, public servants, running around like headless chickens, following every word of an insane man who the United States is torturing, and then leaping, screaming, the U.S. is, at every word he utters. This is the war on terror. Welcome to it. It is that complicated, that harrowing, and this is exactly some of what people point to in terms of the 1% doctrine. We need a better model than this.
Mm, you write, and you sort of paraphrase that, but I'd written down what you wrote exactly, quote, "The United States would torture a mentally disturbed man, then leap, screaming at every word he uttered." Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Hyannis, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, Ron. My question is, given this 1% doctrine, are we slipping towards a totalitarian form of government? This seems to give discretion for extreme military and intelligence actions with a small cabal of, you know, leaders in the White House. But with all the other things that are controversial that are going on in the federal government, having to do with the loss of balance in the three branches of government, my question is, you know, have we already shifted to some different kind of government without a violent takeover?
Ron Suskind, what do you think? That's a pretty heavy question for Michael,
but
let's put it on the table and have you respond.
Well, Michael, you know, certainly I'm not ready to attest to the fact that we've slipped down the abyss here that you mentioned. I will say this, is that what the 1% doctrine now does, now that we know what it is, it's been disclosed, it does fix accountability. It shows that the things that have occurred are by intention, by design of the vice president, but really of the government. It's been accepted, the Cheney Doctrine. And what it does is it provides justification. This is the justification for many of the things that here and around the world people are so concerned about. You know, you have two sides here. You've got issues of principles that guide the nation and what those principles ought to be, how they ought to be preserved. On the other side, you've got the tactical issues of how we may have failed on the tactical mission of doing what we need to do to win this war. Every time, you know, you round up 100 innocent people, like we did with Muslim Americans or folks overseas, torture some of them, keep them in prison indefinitely, we create essentially counter-responses, almost multiplying the problems and the threats that we face. We push people around the world from anger, lots of people have anger toward the United States more than ever, toward violence. That threshold, we're not clear enough as to why people make that step. But if one out of 100 makes that step versus one out of 10,000, we're facing an army that would be overwhelming for us in the modern age. That's the dialogue we need to be having.
Ron, I want to talk to you about, again, sort of getting back to some of the sources who helped you out here. A lot of them are intelligence experts, and you sort of refer to this tension, this divide in the administration between people who you call the invisibles, who are often at odds with the people you call the notables. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by the invisibles, the notables, that tension, and what that's all about?
Sure, sure. You know, what's happening, Anthony, is that there's the conversation as to the war on terror. And I take Iraq, frankly, out of the equation. We can talk about that in a minute. That's
sure.
Not the real war on terror. That's nation-building, regime change. We've done a lot of that in American history. Mm. In terms of the war on terror, the notables are the folks we know, of course, under the media magnifying light. You know, the Condi Rices, the George Tenets, the president, the vice president. They're out there each and every day telling us to be afraid or not afraid or very afraid, reporting on progress. But the folks really fighting the war are just beneath the line of sight, beneath the horizon. I call them the invisibles. And they are ardent and fierce. They have not had vacations since 9/11. And they're the folks who really understand the arc of the conflict from experience, often hard-won experience, stuff that they learned in at least some cases reluctantly. They're the real experts. They're the Eddie Rickenbackers and Sergeant Yorks of this era in this odd secret war. Which
and they're the ones who aren't being heard, you suggest.
Absolutely. And they come to me in droves because they're concerned about often what the notables are saying. Not so much George Tenet. They tend to like Tenet. But Condi and the vice president and the president, you know, Stephen Hadley, they say, you know, so much of what they say from on high is a false for no reason we can deign. It's not as though the truth wouldn't be something the American people ought to know. All we can say is that it's for political, you know, calculation or political harvesting or for self-aggrandizement to say, hey, everyone, we elected officials are doing a great job. Or in many cases, what they say is what the president or the vice president tells America, tells the American public, is actually hurting our cause. Mm-hmm. It's making our battle, the real battle, harder, not easier, by multiplying our enemies, even in many cases because the president seems more interested in energizing his base than on the effects of some of his words overseas. That's a political choice, and the book shows how some of those political choices are hurting us in this war at which so much is at stake.
And one of the ways I imagine that it's hurting us, I mean, do we risk losing some of these so-called invisibles, the people who actually know what's going on and that can provide the kind of analytical information for us to upon which to build sensible policies? Are we losing them?
Gosh, losing them. They have left the government in droves. These are people who stay up at night. They are so ardent, so worried, so concerned about the conduct in the war on terror. Not only generations of them have already left the government at this point. One of the things I think history will say and judge harshly is that the administration's political decision to blame the CIA for not only pre-9/11 intelligence, even though the president was clearly briefed, and the supposition of WMDs in Iraq, that tactical calculation, which was politically advantageous for the administration, meant certainly that the CIA in this political environment would be gutted, would be eviscerated for the most part. It would go through purges, and it has, you know, by virtue of that very decision. Those purges washed away not only all of the key people in the Tenet era, many of whom who had key trust relationships with some reluctant friends, let's just say, in the Arab world, but even the folks who replaced them were washed away. That, on balance, made the country weaker, more vulnerable to attack. That's the heart of what I think is a kind of bargain, a Faustian bargain, a contradiction in terms of the broad interests of America and the political interests of those in power, which I think history will look very harshly on, especially after a next attack. Ultimately, it's made us weaker.
And you talk about this, and this gets very much back to Vice President Dick Cheney being representing the sort of center of gravity in this war on terror. I mean, this was a result, as you describe, of Dick Cheney, basically seizing the initiative from then CIA Chief George Tenet. I mean, it was a real face-off, and Cheney won.
Well, you know, Cheney's got more power than Tenet. You know, let's be frank about it. Tenet arrived day after day from the planet of evidence. That's what CIA does. I mean, they gather what they can. They try to make sense of it. He is supposed to advise the president. That's what a CIA director, that's what they do and have done for a long time. Ultimately, though, he's often essentially briefing the vice president. That bends things out of shape. Beyond that, each day, Tenet comes with the evidence to a place that has already divorced itself from the idea that evidence matters. That creates tension, obviously, in the life of a guy like Tenet. Look, Tenet made plenty of mistakes. They're in the book. But the fact is, because CIA, Tenet, and his whole crowd was so politically irresistible in terms of blame for everything, that the CIA essentially got blistered here. Mm. And I think that's something that we'll see. You'll see it in the book. You'll say, my God, who is it anymore who can do what Tenet used to do, which is poke the Saudi leader in the chest or talk turkey with Musharraf? That's ultimately what will get us the information we need before the moment of crisis.
Let's go to Brian, who's calling from Lake Placid, New York. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for calling. What's up? What's on your mind?
Well, I do believe in the 1% solution, and I think that the proof is in the pudding that we haven't been attacked since 9/11. That this administration is doing the right thing, and that this is the way that we wage the war on terror.
So, Brian, the fact that we haven't been attacked since 9/11 is proof positive that the 1% doctrine seems to be working. Let me put that to Ron Suskind. You actually address this in the book, Ron, the idea that we haven't been attacked. We can take some comfort in that, but you suggest perhaps not too much comfort.
Well, you know, I think that's been oversold to the American people by the folks in the White House. They know better. But the fact is they garnered lots of political capital, especially running up to the 2004 reelection, to say reelect us because we haven't been attacked. Meanwhile, at that very moment, inside the councils of state, the Situation Room, the Oval Office, the analysis is clear that al-Qaeda may not have wanted to attack us until, frankly, a time of their choosing when they can muster and pull together the audacity of something bigger than 9/11. That's the way the real analysis flows inside of the White House.
I mean, is it even stronger than that? I mean, what I took away from that section of your book is that this is the conclusion that the people who really know this is that this country is basically indefensible.
That is the conclusion. That is everybody in the know, those with the most pertinent, up-to-date information, say essentially the homeland security idea is one that is probably empty at its core. This is not something that's news to al-Qaeda. You know, our borders are essentially indefensible. We've even lost people that the CIA has recommended to FBI, saying a bad guy's coming to America, follow him. FBI's lost them. They say that in various meetings in the Situation Room.
But to get back to Brian's question, Ron, what are the prevailing theories as to why there has been no second attack or post 9/11 second wave?
The idea, simply put, is that the second wave attack will, according to al-Qaeda's playbook, need to be bigger and more destructive, audacious than 9/11. That creates an upward arc of terror and anticipation from that second attack to whatever follows. That upward arc that's what they're about, to create a sense of terror, a sense of futility, a sense of almost resignation that we can't win because they have a tactical advantage. That's the real playbook of al-Qaeda. They sometimes spend years planning attacks because they actually are quite strategic. You know, the Cheney Doctrine, people criticize it in some cases inside the government. They say it's a tactical model. It's not really a strategic model. Strategy is something where actions flow into a broader plan that gets us moving forward. Ultimately, we need a strategic model. And even now in the government, I think some folks are saying we don't have one. The Cheney Doctrine, the 1% Doctrine isn't that. We need one, and we need it now, and we need it desperately.
Is the conclusion that the U.S. is basically indefensible from another al-Qaeda-style attack? I mean, I gather from what you're saying that this comes from this lower level of folks, these so-called invisibles. Do the notables acknowledge this? I mean, do they really I mean, obviously, they're not going to say that out loud to the American people, but is it the people who you call the notables, is it your sense that they understand that and accept that?
There is no doubt that the notables understand, accept that, though they certainly are not telling that publicly to the American people. I think that's a breakdown of the kind of public dialogue that Americans have trusted over the years and deserve. You know, the fact is that we're all in this together. You know, as I say in the book, I run an epigram from Thomas Jefferson, an informed public can be trusted with its government. I think part of the idea here is the least possible information we can offer them. That'll be our standard. It should be the most they can offer us. And this book is full of literally dozens of disclosures that up to now have been sealed in silence and secrecy. None of them advantage al-Qaeda. There's stuff that in some cases the terrorists knew years ago have already responded to, but it allows finally Americans to have a debate, a real debate, fact-based, as obviously, I kind of coined the term reality-based debate about our future. That's part of our birthright, I suppose.
Let's go to Maureen, who's calling from Marlboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Maureen.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
My question is what Colin Powell's role was in 9/11 and when he went to the United Nations and talked about the WMD and how sure that everyone was that it actually existed. What exactly was his position in did he leave because he was so against Cheney?
Okay, Maureen.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Maureen. Ron, Colin Powell's role.
Sure, sure. Thanks, Maureen. I put this under the category of the White House could muster the tactical forcefulness with which it's treated people like Powell in terms of Iraq, we would probably be in better shape than we're in now. Powell, like Tenet, like others, were facing a concerted multi-pronged assault from people in the White House and the Defense Department to get the message they decided was appropriate out, even if it had often nothing to do with what was real. Powell was overwhelmed prior to his presentation at the UN. He was getting barraged with information from the White House, from Scooter Libby, from the Vice President's office. You know, much of it just a sort of garbage analysis. And CIA was with Powell trying to, you know, it's like a game of capture the flag, you know, where they flood the zone. They're trying to basically stop people before they get to the flag, which is Powell's credibility put on the line to support the administration's case, even though they had already divorced themselves from evidentiary models. Ultimately, the administration succeeds. Powell does spend his hard-earned credibility at the UN. Powell is irate about this. I think he's sort of made that clear in public. Later, he bumps into Scooter Libby. That's in the book. And Libby essentially says, you know, we were just making a case like a lawyer makes a case in court. Of course, Powell's thinking at that point, yeah, without opposing counsel. That wasn't described to me when I went before the UN. I thought I was going to be an explainer rather than a persuader. Look, ultimately what you see here is Powell, being a reality-based public servant, was cut out of the equations very, very early, a little bit like Paul O'Neill was or Christy Todd Whitman. They provide a challenge, a fact-based evidentiary challenge to many of the ideologies or things that were decided early on. These guys were asking questions about the whys. The administration was already well into the house.
Let's go to Joey, who's calling from Old Lyme, Connecticut. Hi, Joey. You're on the air.
Hi. My question concerns the changing of the Constitution in this whole situation where Congress has essentially handed over their ability to wage war to the administration. Where does the Congress ever get their voice back and start making decisions instead of the presidency?
Well, that's a big question. Let's put that on the table. Ron Suskind, do you feel that Congress and congressional oversight, its responsibilities of oversight, have essentially been abandoned?
Yeah, well, there's no doubt they've been profoundly compromised. Again, you'll see in the book moments of that where they simply are not briefed about all sorts of things. And the White House has long felt, Cheney certainly has felt, and even before 9/11, that the president's power should be expanded. Cheney believes that they were diminished during Watergate, a time in which he was in the White House. Most people feel the president's powers have recovered since then. Cheney doesn't. And he has moved forcefully to expand presidential power. After 9/11, that preparation met a kind of opportunity, and the expansion has been profound. Congress, I'm not sure what it'll take for Congress to get its voice back. I think they all probably should grab copies of the Constitution, look at the chapters applying to them. In this case, though, clearly the administration, in an open-ended war, look, we've had wars before. We've had issues of war powers, the suspension of rights like habeas corpus under Lincoln, some under Roosevelt. Those wars had a timeline. They ended, and everyone understood it's going to end this special, unique period and an extraordinary time. This is an open-ended battle. The president, others say it's a twilight struggle. It'll last to the lives of our grandkids, but the powers have been seized. And there does not seem to be a clear finishing point, and that's causing concern.
There's so many disclosures that come to light in this book, and before we run out of time, I want to try to get to at least one more because it's an unsettling one. Talk a little bit about the First Data Corporation, how the FBI convinced First Data, this is among the largest processors of credit card transactions in the U.S., to essentially hand over its records after 9/11. What happened there? And talk about the significance of that kind of approach.
Well, First Data felt natural urges after 9/11, lots of companies did, to say, is there any way we can help? Mm-hmm. They contacted FBI a few days after the attacks. FBI said all sorts of ways you can help, and they quickly sort of set up an operation. They had an outlocation near one of an FBI First Data office right near one of First Data's processing centers. There were countless credit card searches that were done. In fact, the evidence shows they were papered. It was a flurry of paper, you know, subpoenas, national security letters. You could paper the walls with all the paper generated. And they did essentially chase down countless leads, thousands of leads, that resulted in some cases, arrests, incarceration, many of them of innocent people, Muslim American men. You know, think of it this way. It's a communications head, largely provided by the NSA and its telecom partners, and a financial body. That's the way this big global matrix was created. Those First Data searches weren't particularly valuable. You know, it's sort of like looking in the wrong end of the telescope to search all of a kind of thing, or it's grape shot. It becomes more targeted with one of First Data's companies. It owns Western Union. It's the owner of that old brand name. Western Union, of course, is the operation of choice for terrorists. 9/11 terrorists use Western Union to wire money. Western Union does something that is extraordinary and a next step, really, beyond anything that's been reported up to now in the New York Times or elsewhere, where they set up a kind of wire transfer trap where pretty much intelligence might be offered as to who's coming to a Western Union office. In this case, in the specific incident in the book in Lebanon, that's a bad guy. But where is the money being wired to? That's always the question. It's not the person sending the money. It's who's picking it up. Mm. That's the valuable person. Western Union instantly provides that information. Justice Department has an office so that it all happens seamlessly, almost instantaneously. That intelligence is passed to Shin Bet, the Israeli Army intelligence forces. They follow the courier to the safe house, and the balance of power, of force, and of violence changes in the West Bank and Gaza in one of the world's oldest conflicts because of Western Union's engagement through the auspices of the United States government. The question here is, should we have Fortune 100 companies carrying forward U.S. policy in secret? And that's, you know, that's the question in terms of First Data and Western Union and countless other companies. We need a debate about that. We need to know where to draw the lines, because right now, frankly, it's a mess.
Ron, that's one of the questions that your book poses for sure that I think is going to be debated for a while. I have one more question. We have about 20 seconds, literally, for the answer. The Bush administration has voiced a lot of concerns about the kind of leak that is represented in your book. And they suggest that this actually could endanger U.S. security. And I'm just wondering if, you know, respond to that in any way. Is there any way your book, revealing some of the stuff that you revealed, could actually, you know, help our enemies imperil national security? I know you've been asked this before.
Absolutely not. I went through fierce due diligence on this score. Every person I talked to, I said, would this in any way compromise our national security? And in every case, they said no. And in every case, they said the people ought to know this, not just now, especially after the next attack. They feel one will come. And you know what they said? People will say to us, how could you not have told us these things? Mm-hmm. That at this point, we absolutely were ready to know and deserve to know.
Well, Ron, the book is The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11. Ron Suskind, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a great hour, and I appreciate your time.
No, thank you, Anthony. It's been lovely.
I'm Anthony Brooks, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.